Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, two American soldiers kidnapped in Iraq last week are thought to have been tortured and beheaded. The U.S. military has not confirmed that publicly, but today's Washington Post quotes witnesses in Iraq who say that 23-year-old Christian Menchaca of Texas and 25-year-old Thomas Tucker of Oregon were dragged behind pickup trucks, then beheaded and dismembered. And today's Houston Chronicle reports that military officials have told Private Menchaca's family that the two soldiers were beheaded. Private Tucker's father, Wes, told the Today Show this morning that he is proud of his son and he understands his son's killers.
Our son was there doing a job. The people over there that did this, they are sons and they're doing their job.
The news comes as the Marine Corps announced its plans to charge seven Marines and one sailor with murder in the death of an Iraqi civilian. Well, we turn now to UPI Pentagon reporter Pam Hess. And Pam, first to the deaths of the U.S. soldiers. It is a morbid topic, but questions arise. Any sense, first of all, when the military might say more about how these soldiers died?
I'm not sure how much detail they're going to give us on the record about that. They don't want to be seen as being insensitive to the families. I think the fact that the families have been told maybe paves the way. But it would also give a public relations victory to the people that did this if all the gruesome details are sort of trotted out. It's exactly what they want.
Well, that is the angle we wondered about. If this was indeed a beheading of U.S. soldiers, would this be a first in Iraq? And is it thought that this might mark any turning point or any new agenda for the insurgents?
I don't know exactly if it's a first in Iraq for U.S. soldiers being beheaded, but beheading is something that happens there actually quite often. Just a couple of weeks ago, they found something like 34 heads in several bags on the highway near Bakuba. It's actually an old traditional desert practice where you would have an assassin sent out to kill someone and they bring back the head as proof that they did the job and get their money. So it's something that actually has some odd cultural resonance for folks. And it's also something that freaks Americans out. So,
well,
I think that's why they would do it.
Sure. And we should mention that one U.S. soldier was killed and several injured in pursuit and in search of these two soldiers, and that they were surrounded by mines. Their remains were surrounded by bombs.
Yeah,
And so I'm just wondering, is this in any way fueling some of the debate that you're hearing, some of the questions about Iraq, or is it just considered just one of just another gruesome report from the war?
I think it complicates right now the decision that General Casey is supposed to be making, which is to reduce troop levels in Iraq. It'll be hard for him to rationalize reducing troop levels in Iraq if this is something that happened. There's not necessarily a correlation between the two. The more questions that are coming up are how this could have happened. It's highly unusual to be in an area like Yusufiya, which is known as the Triangle of Death, or it's the center of the Triangle of Death, to leave a small group, one Humvee and three guys, alone anywhere. It's not enough to protect yourself. So there's an investigation that's going into that to figure out how it happened. I know many folks over there who have talked about ambushes, that they've been attacked and they've had an opportunity to chase after the people that did, but declined that out of the fear of this very thing happening, that they're being led into a trap, trying to separate them.
Well, you mentioned General Casey meeting with Defense Secretary Rumsfeld as soon as today. Any sense in the few seconds we have of an announcement of troop cuts?
Maybe tomorrow we would hear something, but I think that we shouldn't expect too much. They've just announced the new rotation of troops coming in, and I think they want to delay as long as possible any decision that they make. This is probably not the best week to talk about reducing troops because of the emotions that surround this kidnapping and mutilation of the two soldiers.
Pam Hess, covering the Pentagon for UPI. Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Bush is in Vienna, Austria today for the annual U.S.-European Union summit. He spoke at a press conference this morning about the war in Iraq, nuclear threats from Iran and North Korea, and pressure from European leaders to close down the detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The president reiterated his desire to, quote, end Guantanamo, and pointed out that about 200 detainees had been sent home. But he added,
there are some who need to be tried in U.S. courts. They're cold-blooded killers. They will murder somebody if they're let out on the street, and yet we believe there's a There ought to be a way forward in the court of law, and I'm waiting for the Supreme Court of the United States to determine the proper venue in which these people can be tried.
President Bush in Vienna, noting a highly anticipated Supreme Court decision that could come down in the next week and a half on a Guantanamo-related case. In the meantime, some insight into Guantanamo and the problems of determining guilt among detainees comes from a new film that tells the story of three young British Muslim men who were held at Gitmo for more than 2 years.
You're now the property of the U.S. Marine Corps. This is your final destination.
Down!
Third pole. Don't let him look. Don't let him look.
That's a scene from The Road to Guantanamo. It tells the story of the Tipton Three, named for their British hometown. Rul Ahmed, Asif Iqbal, and Shafiq Rasool say they went to Pakistan to attend an arranged wedding for one of them in the weeks after 9/11. They claim they decided on a lark to go to Afghanistan. It's portrayed in the film as half humanitarian mission, half bachelor party. But then they say they were captured, accused of being Taliban fighters, and sent to Guantanamo Bay, where they say they were tortured before being cleared and released. They're now suing the U.S. for $10 million apiece. Joining us on the line from England is one of the Tipton Three, Rul Ahmed, who was 19 years old when he was sent to Guantanamo Bay. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also one of the film's directors, Matt Whitecross. Matt, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Rul, I want to ask you the question that I'm assuming you've been asked. It's the one that jumps out at the beginning of the film and stays there throughout. What were you thinking? Why were you in Afghanistan?
Well, the whole reason we went to do humanitarian aid work in Afghanistan, but the main reason was, I think, we was more curious about the Taliban government. We really wanted to go to Afghanistan and had basically to have a look what the government was about. It was also like an adventure.
Well, there's a scene then that shows the type of treatment you say you received in Guantanamo Bay once you arrive there, in solitary confinement. It includes having loud rock music blaring into the cells, lights flashing. We're going to play a clip of it, which has one of the Tipton Three sort of narrating again as a witness, and then a dramatic reenactment. Let's listen.
The leg irons are attached to the hook. Then they put your hands between your ankles at the floor and chain you to the hook on the floor as well. Keep you there for like an hour, sometimes 2 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours.
Rul Ahmed, when you weren't in solitary confinement, you and your two friends were in these cages, one person to a cage, open to the sun.
You couldn't move at all, you know, and couldn't put a towel or a sheet. You couldn't hang it up on the fence to block the sunlight that was breaking camp rules. So it was really, really hard. It was humid and hot.
And Rul, you know, in the film, your time seems to be completely involved with trying to figure out what the guards want you to do. We don't really hear a lot of your inner life. What were you thinking when you were in Guantanamo?
To be honest with you, at the beginning, I used to always think about home. Me, my family, me, my girlfriend, me and my friends going out, chilling out in my car, smoking dope. These memories would, like, kind of haunt you. And it would hurt, like, it would affect you psychologically. So eventually, I think we all learned to blank our minds 24 hours a day, 24/7, and to think about nothing. It's hard to do, but when you are put into a situation like Guantanamo, you have to force yourself to adapt to a different lifestyle.
What did you think when you heard that three other Guantanamo detainees committed suicide, successfully committed suicide, because many have tried?
Obviously, it upset me, because I knew one of the detainees, because I spent few weeks with him. He was in my cellmate for a while, but it's totally understandable why they committed suicide. I mean, when I was there for the for 2.5 years, there's many times I thought I committed suicide, because you don't get the phone home, you don't get to write letters, you're stuck in the island, hot as hell, don't know why you're there, they don't release you, they don't tell you nothing, so you start thinking about killing yourself. So in one way, I do understand why they committed suicide.
The American government also came with photographs claiming to show you and your friends at a rally for Osama bin Laden in 2000. What did you say to that?
Well, basically, it was just an allegation. The picture quality was so bad that I could say it was you in the photo, but they kept on accusing of us being in that photo, and we just got tortured for about 4 or 5 months. And at the end, we confessed to something that we didn't do,
Well, in fact, we want to play another scene. It describes what you claim was this torture that you talk of by U.S. Troops at Guantanamo Bay, which is what led you to confess. Let's listen.
I was put in a room with AC on. Then I was put in stress positions.
Help! Help!
They wanted me to say I was a fighter. Once I said I was a fighter, the next thing is, you're a member of Al-Qaeda. Once you say you're a member of Al-Qaeda, they're going to... That's it.
You say you're a fighter, huh?
Yeah.
Are you a fighter?
Yeah, just stay right there.
Is that why you confessed, so that that it would stop?
Yeah, that was the obvious reason. And plus the interrogators, who's to torture us, they should say to us, you know, just confess to it. Just confess that you were there and you were a member of Al-Qaeda. You are a jihadist and we will stop all this torture.
The torture stopped, and then something was discovered that what you were saying initially was true, that you couldn't have been in Afghanistan in 2000 in an Osama bin Laden camp because, in fact, you were in the UK and there were ways to prove that. What were the ways to prove that?
In 2000, all through 2000, I was in court, and at the same time I was on bail, and also I was doing community service because I had got into trouble with the police, violence and disorder, and a few petty things, really.
Well, it turned out to be your ticket out, ironically, because that was proof that you weren't in the UK at the time the tape was made, which was the evidence against you. In response to your lawsuit rule, Pentagon spokesman Major Michael Shavers told the paper here in Boston that you were captured fighting illegally for Al-Qaeda, that the Department of Defense determined the detention was directly related to combat activity, and there's no basis for the U.S. to pay claims for your detention.
Why was I released? If that is the case, why was I released? The public in America should ask the government, if Guantanamo Bay is open for terrorists, then why was the Tipton 3 released?
Matt, you say you made this film in the hopes of shutting down Guantanamo. As we know, the Supreme Court is about to make a decision that could directly relate to the future of the Guantanamo Bay prisons.
We really hope that people can see it and can wake up to what's going on there, what's still going on in their name.
Rule, how have you been received back in Tipton? Do people believe you?
Well, I mean, I don't know, you know, I think it's 50-50, you know. Some people are okay with us, but I think as time has gone by, they're believing us more. At the beginning, I think they were just a bit scared of the backlash because the area we live in is predominantly white.
Unfortunately, because there is a lot of racism in that area, I think a lot of the local community just thought, either they thought there was no smoke without a fire, or they thought, well, we don't want to be associated with these people, whether they're innocent or guilty.
And, Rule, I want to ask you, if even half of what you portray in the film is true, one would wonder, how do you feel about the U.S.?
How do I feel about the U.S.? I've got nothing against the U.S., the country itself, or the civilians. The people of America have done nothing to me, but I totally hate Bush and his regime and his administration.
That's Rule Ahmed. He's one of the main characters in the film The Road to Guantanamo. He was held by U.S. forces for more than 2 years in Guantanamo Bay before being released and cleared. Matt Whitecross co-directed the film. It won the Silver Bear Prize at the Berlin International Film Festival earlier this year. It begins a limited release in the U.S. on June 23rd. I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And more ahead here and now. Now, we just heard from a former detainee who was held at the U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay. He and two of his friends were released after more than 2 years. They claim they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and in fact, evidence surfaced that cleared them. But U.S. officials say that finding evidence and witnesses for other detainees at Guantanamo has been nearly impossible. Well, is it? A 2004 Supreme Court ruling declared that the U.S. military had to hold hearings for more than 500 prisoners being held without charge at Guantanamo or grant them federal trials. The detainees were allowed to request overseas witnesses to help prove their innocence. The government deemed most of those witnesses unavailable. But Boston Globe reporters were able to find three witnesses in one case in just 3 days. Correspondent Declan Walsh tracked down two of those witnesses in Afghanistan. He's still there. He joins us on the line from Kandahar. And Declan, how difficult was it for you to find these witnesses?
It really wasn't very difficult, to be honest, Robin. One of the witnesses is actually an advisor on tribal affairs in the office of the president, Hamid Karzai. That was relatively straightforward. The second witness was a little bit more complicated. His original name was mistyped on the transcript, but when we went to his hometown of Gardez, his family and local officials were able to very quickly identify the official that he was referring to, and within about a couple of hours we had a phone number, we called him, and the next day we met him in Kabul.
Well, you know, you were saying these two witnesses were officials. That gives us a hint as to who this detainee was. Tell us more about the detainee whose witnesses you were trying to find, Abdullah Mujahid. Who is he?
Abdullah Mujahid was the police commander in Gardez province. Pretty much from the fall of the Taliban up until July of 2003. He was a former Mujahideen commander. The Mujahideen were the fighters who fought the Soviet Union, and many of whom also opposed the Taliban when they came to power. So Abdullah Mujahid was arrested in July 2003, allegedly because he was anti-American, and allegedly because he planned an unspecified attack on U.S. forces. The problem with the allegations is that many of the people we spoke to in Gardez felt that he was innocent, and there was no way that he would have participated in an anti-American attack, particularly as he had participated in a battle against Taliban fighters in early 2002.
Well, and in fact, you went and put together the pieces, and you found that perhaps he might have been, maybe something of a bully as a boss in the job that he had. But he had contacts in very high places who were willing to vouch for the fact that perhaps, he also had enemies who just turned him in.
That's right. I mean, Abdullah Mujahid didn't come away from this smelling of roses, if you like. A number of people said that, he may have been involved in corruption, he may have been involved in some bullying. It seems that he's an uneducated man who had spent most of his life fighting. You have to remember that here in Afghanistan, memories and rivalries dating back to the Soviet War of the 1980s are still very much alive. So many, many of Abdullah's friends and relatives seem to think that he may have been turned into the Americans by somebody who didn't like him because of a long-standing rivalry. Of course, we have no way of confirming this or not, but it was a common explanation.
Do you think that the witnesses that you tracked down, one of the four witnesses on Mujahid's list had died, but do you think that the other three that the paper tracked down could have cleared him?
Well, certainly two of the witnesses that we tracked down strongly supported the evidence that Abdullah Mujahid gave at the military tribunal in Guantanamo Bay. And the third witness is Ali Ahmed Jalali, who was the Interior Minister of Afghanistan at that time. And he did say that he didn't think Mujahid was a particularly good person, and he hinted that there may be some evidence against him that he wasn't willing to disclose. And we also spoke with senior people such as the former governor of the province, the head of the Interpol police in Afghanistan, and all of these people told us that they firmly believed that Abdullah Mujahid was an innocent man.
Well, the Boston Globe staff found that 34 detainees convinced tribunal officials that overseas witnesses would provide relevant testimony, but none of those witnesses was found. In your research, what were the reasons given for not locating those witnesses?
The military lawyers and officials who heard these cases said in the transcripts that they have contacted the government of Afghanistan, asked them for access to these witnesses, and didn't receive any response. And that seems like a fairly lame excuse, particularly as these people are readily identifiable personalities. And it's really difficult to see why it's necessary to wait for someone within the Afghan government to call the energy minister, for instance, when that person is easily contactable. So on the face of it, it certainly does seem that that there really isn't any excuse for contacting at least some of these people, if not most of the witnesses.
I was interested in the last line in your article. You met a lot of Afghans in doing your work, and one of them said to you, "This is a great sadness between our countries that will last for many years."
I think anti-American sentiment has risen to some degree in Afghanistan recently, and there have been a number of civilian casualties following raids on Taliban shelters here in Kandahar province, for instance. And Guantanamo Bay is really one of the big issues that, if you like, sticks in the throats of Afghans. They really see it as being a process that's deeply unfair. You have to remember that a large number of the detainees in Guantanamo come from Afghanistan, like Abdullah Mujahid. They say these cases, if there's a criminal case to answer, should be dealt with here in Afghanistan, not several thousand miles away.
Declan Walsh, a foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe, based in Afghanistan. He's speaking to us from Kandahar. He recently wrote a piece about the U.S. government's failure to provide witnesses for detainees at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. Declan, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can always give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. And tomorrow on Here and Now is Somalia. Better off now that Islamic militias are in control of Mogadishu. We're going to speak to Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes. And now, a congressional vote to renew the 1965 Voting Rights Act was put on hold today because Southern Republicans say the legislation unfairly singles out their states for federal oversight. The Voting Rights Act followed the original Civil Rights Bill introduced by President John F. Kennedy in 1963 and signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson after Kennedy's assassination. Well, a new book takes a close look at Kennedy's legacy on civil rights. It's called The Bystander, and it portrays Kennedy as a congressman who battled for civil rights, but a president who was afraid civil rights would fracture the Democratic Party, a fear not unfounded. Author Nick Bryant joins us. And Nick, just by this title, The Bystander, you're taking a bit of the sheen off the JFK myth here, aren't you?
Absolutely. I argue that at the beginning of the 1960s, John F. Kennedy had a historic opportunity to forge a national consensus on race and also to move America towards a much more peaceful transition towards an equitable society in which African Americans would at last get the chance to enjoy a full menu of basic civil rights. But he decided to downplay civil rights at the outset of his presidency. He didn't speak out in favor of civil rights. He didn't introduce the legislation that he'd promised during his campaign. And what this did was encourage white segregationists in the South who'd upheld this system of racial apartheid to believe they could keep Jim Crow well into the 1960s.
Let's take a look at this criticism and knock it about a bit. I mean, is it really fair? Because as you write, the pivotal moment in the story is Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And just 5 weeks before this, admittedly a couple of years after he's in office, but just 5 weeks before this, Kennedy had unveiled the most far-reaching civil rights bill that a president had ever put before Congress. He appeared on television against the advice of his aides to ask the American people to examine their conscience. He cast civil rights as a moral issue, which hadn't been done. And, you know, perhaps, you know, he understood that because of how vociferous, how fiercely held the beliefs of the Southerners were, he had to move slowly.
But Robin, by that stage, he had no other choice but to lead. Between the Birmingham demonstrations, in which Martin Luther King launched the Birmingham campaign against Bull Connor, one of the most notorious segregationists in the South, between those demonstrations and the March on Washington, there have been 1,300 demonstrations across America, not just in the South, in the North as well. We saw them in New York City. We saw them in Chicago, Philadelphia. They had a violent edge. In Birmingham, Alabama, blacks had gone on the rampage through the streets. We saw black-on-white violence for the first time. It absolutely terrified the Kennedy administration. That's why I decided to go on television in June 1963. That's why I decided to introduce the far-reaching Civil Rights Bill, which is the most far-reaching civil rights bill that any president had ever introduced. By that stage, Robin, JFK had no choice but to lead. People within the administration were warning that America was on the brink of a new civil war.
Right, because you're saying that, yes, he did those things, but it was late in coming. It had possibly exacerbated the situation. Let's remind ourselves, because you mentioned Birmingham, we think of the dogs, the water cannons, the images we're familiar with, but you remind us in your book how much more there was across the country.
Black pastors who'd preached nonviolence from their pulpits for so long didn't preach nonviolence anymore. They said that blacks would have to take to the streets. Many of them were advocating violent protest tactics. Confronted by the president's inaction, blacks were forced to adopt much more militant tactics, and they demanded much more radical policies. By 1963, blacks were demanding affirmative action, quotas, compensatory programs, reparations, and it became much more difficult for any president to mobilize white public opinion, to win white public support for those kind of policies.
As we said, the president did address the nation on television on June 11th, 1963. This is the day Governor Wallace tried to block two black students from registering for classes at the University of Alabama. Let's first listen to some of Kennedy's speech.
This is one country. It has become one country because all of us and all the people who came here had an equal chance to develop their talents. We cannot say to 10% of the population that you can't have that right, that your children can't have the chance to develop whatever talents they have, that the only way that they are going to get their rights is to go in the street and demonstrate. I think we owe them and we owe ourselves a better country than that.
As you write, an intensity and passion from Jack Kennedy, if you had seen, he departed from his prepared script. But you question his motives.
My argument is the speech came too late. Mm-hmm. Many of Kennedy's advisers wanted him to make a bold statement about civil rights in his inaugural address. He refused to do it. Many of his advisers, like Arthur Schlesinger, for instance, wanted him to champion civil rights in a major speech in the South very early on in his presidency. He refused to do it. He came into office promising he would offer moral leadership. He blamed President Eisenhower for failing to do that. But Kennedy kept silent on the question of civil rights. And again, it just led civil rights leaders to believe that the Kennedy administration simply wasn't on their side.
What did President Kennedy say in more intimate moments? What did he say about this decision-making on his part? What did he say about waiting so long to get into the game? I'm wondering, was it the specter of perhaps white violence early on if he tried to push through reform? Did he say anything like that?
JFK showed a numbing indifference to white violence against black protesters early on in his presidency. You remember the Freedom Riders in 1961. When they arrived at Birmingham bus station, they were assaulted by segregationists. The local police let the KKK just go wild. JFK didn't try and stop that. He never made any really significant public speech condemning the violence in the South. What happened in 1963 was that we saw black on white violence for the first time. And this was not only in Birmingham, Alabama, but in the North as well. Northern cities like Chicago, New York, Washington, D.C. Black unemployment was a major problem in 1963. The Kennedy administration was very feared that young blacks who didn't have jobs, who didn't have any faith in government, would just go on the rampage.
Did you find a disconnect between the young Jack Kennedy that you introduced us to, who, you know, campaigned in the black neighborhoods in Cambridge, had friends, even though born with a silver spoon in his mouth, was able to really be on the same level as blacks that he met in ordinary life, seemed to have compassion as a young man? What happened?
Before 1963, people thought that Kennedy just didn't think about civil rights. What I show in the book is that he was a really ardent campaigner, especially in 1946 when he first becomes a congressman. He realizes very early on the importance of the black vote. He targets them in 1946 when he's running for Congress. In 1952, when he's in a Senate race against a very popular incumbent, Henry Cabot Lodge, again, he targets black voters. He really battles to bring an end to segregation in Washington. The nation's capital at that stage had a system of racial apartheid as well. He was worried that the Soviets would take advantage of that for propaganda purposes. But by the middle of the 1950s, as his national ambitions become more pronounced, he realizes that he's not going to win the Democratic presidential nomination if he's only got liberal support in the North, and that's when he compromises on civil rights. In 1960, though, he suddenly realizes that Texan Senator Lyndon Johnson is going to be his main opponent. So he becomes a born-again liberal again, and he uses civil rights to prove his liberal credentials. It's an extraordinary story. I argue in the book that Kennedy wouldn't have become president had it not been for his very clever and dexterous handling of civil rights, which was the most fissile issue of the age.
And, of course, the sadness is he was killed, and so he didn't have a chance to if he would have at all, repair that legacy with civil rights.
But I think he did get a much bigger moral commitment to civil rights. And I also think he decided that he was going to try and reform the Democratic Party. He was going to try and marginalize the segregationists and work on those southern moderates that were emerging in the South. But it is unfortunate that he was cut down just as civil rights was taking a much more central role in his presidency.
Nick Bryan's book, The Bystander, John F. Kennedy and the Struggle for Black Equality. After Kennedy was killed, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Bill into law, reportedly saying to an aide, "We have lost the South for a generation." You're listening to Here and Now. World Cup soccer has provided fans the world over with some thrilling matches, but soccer can also give people a sense of community. Reporter Adam Allington visited the only Hispanic soccer league in Michigan. It's in Traverse City. Most of the players are migrant workers who come to the States to work in fruit orchards. Here's Adam's report.
Few sports feed national pride more than World Cup soccer.
Mexico! Mexico!
You're a big Mexico fan, huh? Why Mexico?
Because me and him are cousins. We're all cousins and we're from Mexico.
The fact that these 5- and 6-year-old kids even know about the World Cup says something about the role of soccer in their lives. But they're not watching Mexico versus Paraguay. They're watching family and friends compete in Michigan's only Hispanic soccer league. Each week, roughly 150 players and fans make the trip to Traverse City for a day of soccer, Mexican style. Fans cheer their team from bleachers or beach chairs. The sound of Tejano music blasts out of pickup trucks. People sell tacos, tamales, and soda off their tailgates. While the atmosphere is considerably more relaxed than a typical World Cup match, many fans carry a different kind of loyalty.
The wives, they got really upset if somebody touched the husband, and they scream. They don't care. They scream. They lose control, and sometimes they say a lot of things, then can offend you even to the referee.
Miguel Osorio owns a Mexican grocery store in Traverse City. He got the idea to form a migrant soccer league in 2002.
Because they're coming from big cities, and they said, "Why you don't organize any football tournament or something?" And I said, "Are you really? How many players do you have?" And said, "I have the whole team." And, you know, people from Santa's Bay, the ones that work on those fields, in Cadillac, in Lake City, in all that area. And I said, "Okay, put a team together, and I challenge you with my team. I will put some people together from Traverse City." Pepe.
Approximately 15,000 Mexican farm workers work in northwest Michigan, harvesting mostly cherries and apples. There are 6 teams in the soccer league. After cherry season, that number could climb up to 8. Johnny Calderon plays on one of those teams, named after a hallowed English Premier League club.
Yeah, one of our favorite teams is the Arsenal team from England, so we just come here and have fun. I mean, it's pretty competitive for being, you know, adult men that work, you know, overtime during the week and just come here and have fun on their day off. And most of these guys are pretty much working 50 or 60 hours a week. So, I mean, that pretty much tells you, you know, passion about the sport.
But the soccer league is not for Hispanics only. David Johnson is one of a handful of Anglos who also play. He says that short of actually going to Mexico, he would never have the chance to experience this much Mexican culture.
It's really true. Like, when I'm out there and they're speaking Spanish, I feel like I could say that, I mean, I went to Mexico today just by the words I'm hearing. And, you know, and compared to playing with, like, other Americans, these guys kick butt.
Large gatherings like the soccer league are rare in northern Michigan. For one, people work a lot, sometimes 7 days a week during harvest. Another reason is because some of the players are undocumented. Border patrol cars are sometimes seen parked outside of grocery stores, churches, and movie theaters. Jessica Gonzalez and her friend are selling tamales. They say people are often too scared to come out.
They don't get together because when you have a large group of Mexicans together, then the cops catch them and then they go to jail. And then what's that one word they go back to Mexico?
Deported? Yeah, that word.
They get deported.
Despite the risk of deportation, people still show up every Sunday to watch and play soccer. And judging from all the smiles and cheers, most wouldn't miss it. Again, Miguel Osorio.
The Spanish people who come and work on the farms, thanks to them, we have nice, delicious cherries or wines on our table. Then it's hard work, but we love to do that. And so I think we deserve some respect. So here in Traverse City, now then when we are together and we found a good amount of people who likes to do sports, and when we are there on the fields, we reminds us like when we were little in Mexico, and looks like we're getting more support every year.
Our visit to the Hispanic Soccer League in Traverse City, Michigan, was produced by Adam Allington. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Here and now. Israeli defense officials are reportedly considering raising the threshold for air attacks on Palestinian militants, canceling strikes if there's even a slim chance of hitting civilians. This follows yesterday's incident in which an Israeli missile mistakenly killed three Palestinian children. It seems that rarely do the decisions of policymakers have as direct an impact on citizens as they do in the Middle East. In big ways, as Palestinian militants hide among civilians and Israelis seek them out with missiles. And in small ways, like trying to arrange a wedding across a border. That's the fictional and often lighthearted story told in the award-winning film from Israel, The Syrian Bride, recently released on DVD. The Syrian Bride tells the story of a young Syrian woman living in the Golan Heights, a region occupied by Israel after the 67 war, but not recognized as Israel's by Syria. This puts her pro-Syrian Druze family with Israeli passports in the middle of a sort of no-man's land. The film plays as a rural domestic comedy, sort of a My Big Fat Greek Wedding with Slaughtered Lamb. It's also profoundly sad at times because Mona, who's engaged to a Syrian cousin she knows only from his daytime TV soap opera, will never see her family again if she crosses the border into Syria to marry him. And The Syrian Bride touches on issues beyond the conflict in the region, racism, sexism, and the generational divide. We spoke with director Aaron Rickless when the film was released in the U.S. He's an Israeli Jew who made his film in Arabic, co-wrote it with a Palestinian-Israeli screenwriter, and cast it with mostly Palestinian-Israelis. It's a film of borders and boundaries, and we asked Aaron to tell us the story.
Every person wakes up, everywhere in the world, wakes up every morning and has to decide, you know, which borders or boundaries does he cross today or he doesn't. And if he does, you know, does he bear the consequences? So that's really what interested me in this context. And in terms of the story, it's really, you know, it's a classical family situation. We're talking about a Druze family at the Golan Heights, but this could be your family, could be my family, and that's the way I approached it.
Druze, a religious minority, mainly make up the Golan Heights, see themselves as Muslim?
Well, they're an offspring of Islam, really, and they live in Syria and the Golan Heights, which, you know, it's debatable whether it's Syrian or Israeli, and in Lebanon and in Israel itself. And the curious thing is that in Israel, in fact, they're totally loyal to Israel and actually serve in the Israeli army, and the Palestinians hate them. So it's a kind of really kind of, you know, chaotic situation, I think, as far as the Druze go. But, you know, I wasn't setting out to do an anthropological film. I kind of felt that, you know, these are people who really, in a nutshell, represent everything I want to discuss in terms of, you know, the actual situation and beyond that. And I think everything you see in the film in terms of the relationships within the family and the relationships within the village and, you know, the broader kind of politics, both local and international, are things that I kind of witnessed and I really experienced throughout my 2 or 3 years of, you know, running around that area. But on the other hand, I could sit at home and probably imagine all this because it's, you know, it works the same way in Ireland, Korea, and for that matter, in Manhattan. You know, it doesn't really matter.
Let's explain some of those universal truths. The father, very pro-Syrian, in fact, spent some time in prison. He can't go to the border to see his daughter off because the police are watching him. The father has a son who's been banned because the son married a Russian. Mm-hmm. A daughter who is having problems with her husband. She wants to go to school in Israel. And so she's sort of on the outs as well. It's not as if there's one unified family with one opinion.
You probably take all the stuff that Shakespeare wrote and just mix it, and you get, you know, what you were just mentioning, because, you know, it's both Romeo and Juliet and it's Hamlet and it's loads of things dealing with, you know, kids and parents and relationships within the family and outside the family, and, you know, codes of honor, which are very strong, obviously, in the Middle East and especially in the Druze society, where, you know, if the eldest son goes off and marries a Russian woman, that's it. You know, it's the end of the world. I think the film is really about, you know, on one hand, the kind of static situation which we encounter in the Middle East day to day. On the other hand, it is about changes in the Middle East, which we also encounter day to day. And that's why I like to refer to this film as a kind of optimistic film, which is really, you know, a little bit optimistic, a little bit pessimistic. And a kind of, you know, if you get the right mixture between the two, you get the true picture of this area.
The Israeli police officer... It's one of the probably the most unsympathetic characters in the film. But even in him, you can see a struggle between doing his job and trying to help the family, giving into appeals from her family. For instance, that the father be allowed to go to the border. The film opens, takes place on the day that Bashar al-Assad comes to power, the current president of Syria, and there's a demonstration, and the bride's father is marching in the demonstration. The Israeli officer says, "Don't do this. Don't march because I have to arrest you, and it's your daughter's wedding day." There's conflict there.
Ahmed, lech habayta, batcha mitchatenet.
Berroh, beddam, nafdik haya shulam.
You know, for me, a lot of Israelis, or a lot of actually, you know, Israelis in the States ask me about this character because obviously, you know, he's kind of tricky. On one hand, he's a cop, you know, he's like a cop everywhere. He's tough. He wants to get his job done. On the other hand, he has his moment of grace where you know, he lets the father off. So I think this is true of all the characters in the film. You know, I was kind of trying to get my stereotypes right, you know, in the sense that... everybody represents something, but on the other hand, he only represents himself. And so all these people are, you know, they're true to life, and they obviously kind of really represent a lot of other people who are involved in this conflict. But, you know, they're people. And as an optimist, in the end, my approach was, you know, every person here has his moment of grace. And not many people, I think, whatever they do in life, can resist this image of a bride at the border, you know, trying to get married. You know, it's a very simple and touching image, and, you know, you can't say no to that.
Fully dressed in her outfit, which she's been in for the duration of the film, trying to wait for all of this to be resolved. And now she's at the border in her beautiful white gown and going back and forth between the checkpoints because the Israelis have put an Israeli stamp on her passport, but the Syrians won't accept it. And into this mix, some other characters come, a Red Cross worker who there's a flirtation between one of the sons and the aid workers. But in any event, that's another story. The Red Cross worker has a conversation with a Syrian border officer as the Red Cross worker tries to help the bride get across. Let's listen.
I told you already, as far as I'm concerned, she comes from Syria and she's going to Syria. She didn't come from Israel.
But what am I supposed to do? Tell me. People are waiting on the other side, on your side too?
I have no idea. It's their problem, not ours. You know, the whole thing is part of an Israeli policy of declaring that the Golan belongs to them. We will never agree to that. You can tell them that.
Aaron Rickless, what would you say to those who might just have a superficial glance at this film and say, this is a film about what the Israelis have done to the poor minorities living in the Golan Heights?
I would say forget that. You know, it's not about politics. It's about, you know, a family situation, and it's about tensions within a family. And you know, I think these tensions and these conflicts and all these issues that the film discusses are close to anyone who has a heart, you know, because I think in the Middle East, but I think it's true today, it was always true, but I think today it's especially true that everything you do, everything you look at is political, wherever you live. You know, the world has become very political. Now, it was also political, you know, in the days of the Greek Empire or the Roman Empire, but I think today the influence of decisions taken by, you know, people in remote places like, you know, the White House or the Kremlin or other places like that in the world have, you know, a direct effect on the lives of people who, you know, all they want to do is, you know, get married, love, hate, whatever. So I think really the film is really about that, you know, and that's why when I say it's not political, I'm not saying that naively. Of course that it's political, but it's only political because it deals with an issue which has immediate kind of results, you know, on a wedding day.
Aaron Rickless, director and co-screenwriter of the film The Syrian Bride, which was recently released on DVD. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.